This morning we're starting a new series, and we're going to be doing this for the next six weeks, not counting the one Addie's here, so called Big Tent. I think I've said before many times in here that I enjoy, one of my things that I love on Sundays is, generally speaking, when I go home from here, I'm pretty tired and done. And so I go home, and the first thing I do is I get the newspaper, which many of you probably already did, and then I go find somewhere to start reading said newspaper until I fall asleep. And it's just a great rhythm and routine. And everybody in the family knows it, so they leave me alone. And one of the things I like, I always say that I read the newspaper to feel like a grown-up so I can justify then spending the rest of Sunday afternoon working on the crossword puzzle. But part of it is I love the editorials. I love reading the editorials page. Saturday editorials, I think I've said this before, is great because you see all the crazy in our community. So that's fun. But Sunday is more of the serious editorials. And I've always loved that kind of stuff. And I find as I get older, I prefer to get my news that way than like this, because this is just driving me crazy these days. Anybody else? That what is news for many of us, if you flip on the Today Show, for example, in the mornings, which I usually do, that's what we get, is a lot of people on screen talking a lot. And often what we do is we get two people who think two opposite things, and then they proceed to talk at each other and over each other, never even listening for the other. It's just lots of people talking all the time. And that's maybe fine in the news world. Maybe that's the way you like your news. But for us, I think the danger is that we're doing a lot of that same stuff in the Christian world as well. Then when it comes to big issues like the five we're going to talk about, it's a lot of cable news feel to it to me. It's blogs and it's sermons and it's books, but it's that feel, right? Of people talking at each other and really nobody coming to any kind of census and nobody at the end of the day. And I don't expect a Democrat and a Republican on the news on the Today Show on Tuesday morning to get done with the segment and talk about how much they love each other and support each other. I don't expect that. But somehow, I don't know what it is about our culture, about Christianity or whatever it is, but somehow it seems like we have that same thing and we're not doing any better at coming together when it's all over. And so that's what's kind of behind this, is we want to spend time for the next 5 weeks talking about things that in many places of the church are very controversial, that cause people to say, I can't worship with you anymore, or I can't associate with you anymore because you believe that way. And so over the next 5 weeks, we're going to talk about creation evolution. Honestly, we're not going to have a ton of time for that because I got to do all this intro stuff. So we're going to move to that one fairly quickly today. But then next week, we're going to talk about pacifism. I didn't even plan the schedule when news of this week happened, right? And so really pertinent to our world today, right? You all pay attention to the news, yes? Super pertinent to our world. And there's strong feelings in the church. And so we're going to talk about pacifism. We're going to talk about denominational differences. I said this at Vision Sunday, but I'll repeat it for those that weren't here. We're going to have a celebration of denominations in, I think that's 3 weeks from now, where we're just going to say everything we can say good about denominations. And I'm going to talk about where denominations come from. But many of us have the experience of having grown up in one denomination and having switched at some point and then being ostracized or shunned or all those feelings. And so we're going to talk some about that. We're going to talk about moral choices. How do we live the way we do? And why do some Christians do some things and some Christians don't do some things? Why do some Christians think that it's okay to drink? And why do others think that alcohol is never okay for any Christians to drink ever, ever, ever? Why is that? And we're going to talk about other issues. And then finally, we're going to talk about the one that is probably the most controversial in the church right now. It's the one that everybody in every church, everywhere in our culture and in our churches are talking about. And so we're just going to talk about it as Christians. How do we navigate when other Christians think very differently than us? Somebody, Josh, sent me an article just yesterday. Last night? Yesterday? Yeah, about Christianity Today just decided it would not run an ad from a group that was saying, do you remember what the ad was? It was something like, the text of the ad was something like, there's two sides to this, and there's God-fearing Christians who believe differently than you, and they wouldn't run the ad. And so it was a really good article about, do we run these things or not? Do we let people that believe differently than us have a say, or do we not? And so we're going to do that over the next couple weeks. Now, I know that it makes some of you nervous. I know some of you have already talked to me this week about some of these. Like, what are you going to say? I'm a little nervous. This is going to freak me out. And I just know some of you are sweating because you don't know what I'm going to say. I don't even know what I'm going to say. So join the club. But I want to say a couple things before we dive into these. The first one is I just want to lay my cards on the table about this. I think love is greater than being right. And I don't know how to say that any other way. I could make it really flowery and take a long time saying it, but I just want to say it as plainly as possible. I think as Christians, our call to love each other is greater than the call to be right. Now, I like to be right, all right? I am right most of the time, all right? We all think we're right, correct? Like that's just the way all of us are. And I don't care whether you're an introvert or extrovert, you're outgoing, you write your own blog or you don't. Secretly, we all know that we're right about everything in the world. It's why we have the opinions we do. If you thought you were wrong, you would change your mind, right? We're all rational people. So if we thought we were wrong about any one of those issues up on the screen, we would change our mind. So we all think we're right about everything. And sometimes we feel compelled, especially with the people closest to us in our life, we feel compelled to make sure that they're right with us because that's important to us. And so the thing that underpins all of this for me, and we're going to read a section of scripture together here in just a second, the thing that underpins all of this series to me is that I believe that it is more important for us as Christians to be loving to each other than to prove that we are right. And I am absolutely right about this slide. I know. I'm just pointing out the irony, all right? I want to read together. Let's just do this. You know, it's funny. There's some passages of scriptures that get read a lot and others that don't ever get read. And one of them that only gets read in a certain context is 1 Corinthians 13. Only at weddings, I think, do I ever hear anybody read 1 Corinthians 13. So we're going to read 1 Corinthians 13 together. I don't think I have time to read the other one. The other one's out of Ephesians. I recommend you read it. It's about unity in the church and Paul equating unity with maturity. That it's mature, when we see Christians being unified, it's a mark of maturity. You can read that on your own. We're going to read 1 Corinthians 13 together. Maybe we should read it every week, but we're going to at least read it today. It's on page 932, if you want to follow along. Otherwise, you can just listen. And yet, I will show you the most excellent way. If I speak in the tongues of men or of angels, but do not have love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal. If I have the gift of prophecy and I can fathom all mysteries and all knowledge, and if I have a faith that can move mountains but do not have love, I am nothing. If I give all I possess to the poor and give over my body to hardship that I may boast but do not have love, I gain nothing. Love is patient. Love is kind. It does not envy, it does not boast, it is not proud. It does not dishonor others. It is not self-seeking, it is not easily angered. It keeps no record of wrongs. Love does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always perseveres. Love never fails. But where there are prophecies, they will cease. Where there are tongues, they will be stilled. Where there is knowledge, it will pass away. For we know in part, and we prophesy in part, but when completeness comes, what is in part disappears. When I was a child, I talked like a child, I thought like a child, I reasoned like a child. When I became a man, I put away the ways of childhood behind me. For now we see only a reflection as in a mirror, then we shall see face to face. Now I know in part, and then I shall know fully, even as I am fully known. And now these three remain, faith, hope, and love. But the greatest of these is love. Let's just take a minute. Thoughts, reflections. As we enter into this series, how does that text help us? What are some of maybe the things that stood out to you as I read? Right, yeah, everybody, even, you know, I think it gets used in weddings, because even if you're really irreligious, who doesn't want to read that at a wedding? Like, it's beautiful, yes. Yeah. I think we all do. How much am I just a clanging gong? Just loud. I'm making noise. All that. Yep. Yeah. Isn't that great? No record of wrongs. What else? Yeah, that thing down there at the end where he talks about being known and fully known, and right now it's dim. I only understand dimly, and I'm not even fully known. And so all of that, like, love is like that thing that goes around that says, you know, okay, seriously. And what happens in relationships of people that we really love and we're close to, we do this, right? When we really care about somebody and we really care about what they think about us, when we talk about opinions, we do it like this. Like, I might be wrong. We want that cushion of love around that. Like, I don't know if you've been in the context where you say to somebody something like, you know, like, I love you and I'm going to say something, but I love you and I just understand that this is all motivated out of my love for you. Like, that's that, yeah. Anything else? Yeah, so we talk about tough love sometimes. Now, I want to say one thing about that, because sometimes, lay my cards on the table. Some of the context I grew up in, I was taught that the most loving thing that you can do for people is tell them the truth. The most loving thing you can do is convince them that you're right and they're wrong. Like, that's the most loving thing. And I understand the context. I'm making fun of that, but I understand the context in which they say that. But there are places in life, And some of you have had these experiences where tough love is a reality. Some of you have addicts in your life and you've had to make really hard choices about, you know what, I'm going to love this person, but I've got to draw some boundaries. And that's right. But in some context, we've taken that idea that applies to a very specific thing in life and we've extended it to everything. And that's just how I'm going to be to everybody. Tough love for everyone. They're going to hear the truth all the time. Yeah, so this is the call in these kinds of conversations. That's really good. So in these kinds of conversations where sometimes people get really animated and really worked up about some of those topics we're going to talk about in the next couple weeks, that we're called to be loving back, not just in our presentation of our ideas, but also to the person that isn't acting loving back to us, which is the hardest thing. I saw something on Facebook the other day where, we'll get into this more next week, where somebody like, are we called to love ISIS? Like, rubber hits the road. Like, are we called to love those people? Because, yikes, that seems really hard. Yeah. Well, no, then. But right now, we're trying to figure it all out. So what we're going to do in the next couple weeks is maybe every week I'll start with the slide, love is greater than being right, and we're going to remember this. Even if we don't have time to read it every week, this is going to be the attitude that we walk into this, okay? And you may really disagree with things I say in the process of this. It's okay. I invite that. It's great. Let's just be loving to each other, and we'll talk it through. So what we're trying to do then in this series comes out of our values. This is one of our directives as a church. It's one of the five things that we're really committed to as a church. So we say we're committed to historic Orthodox Christian faith as found in the Apostles' Creed. This is the line I'm after. We are committed to generous orthodoxy under a banner of love and grace. And we commit ourselves to faithfully study the Bible. What we're talking about this series is this idea, going back to the very beginning of us as a church, is of generous orthodoxy. Now, people read that and they think, oh, that's the name of a book by an author who's heretical. You're right, it is the name of a book and one that I highly recommend. Really good book. And I want to say some things, because what people often say to me is when we start talking generous orthodoxy, they think that what they hear us saying is don't believe in anything. That if we're all going to come to some kind of agreement on those issues that I put on the screen, that we all have to believe kind of nothing so that we can all get along. And I want to make sure I say very loudly and very clearly, that's not what I'm asking us to do in this series. The goal of this is not minimalist orthodoxy, but rather generous orthodoxy. And what I'm hoping in this is, I hope this morning that if you haven't thought about creation and evolution, for example, maybe you'll think about it and maybe you'll come to a thought about, hey, I think that this is what this thing is about. And I hope that you are passionate about that idea. And I hope that when you sit with your friends over coffee and you start talking about that idea, I hope you raise your tone of voice. And I hope that you sweat and spit like I do. Like, I hope you get fired up and that you believe passionately the things that you believe. But I hope that in that, We're generous with that, and we're loving in that. It's not a call for us to all lay down and not believe anything anymore. Is that clear? Do y'all get the distinction here? Because sometimes I think in our culture, we think that to be generous means we have to believe nothing, and we have to let every idea be equal on the table. But that's just sloppy thought, all right? Good thinkers work through things, and they come to formulated opinions and say, I believe this because of X, Y, and Z, and you can disagree with me, but there's a loving exchange. And so that's what we're after. We're after generous orthodoxy, not minimalist orthodoxy. So here's what we're trying to do then, all right? Over the next 5 weeks, we're going to try to do three things. First of all, we're going to do our best to try to understand the other. It is too easy on all of these things to build straw men and set them on fire, right? I'm so good at that in my head. It's like a hobby of mine, right? To build straw men who believe all kinds of crazy things, and then I set them on fire and proclaim myself the winner of the debate. It's awesome. And we do that on blogs, and we do that on, you know, here's the thing about the news sometimes, is when people it feels like they just intentionally misunderstand the other side, right? So then they'd be like, they're the dumbest people alive that believe that thing over there. And what we're going to try to do, if we're going to have a generous orthodoxy, is we're going to try to get inside each other's heads. Think about when you've been with a spouse or a really close friend or somebody you really, really care about, and you find out that they believe very differently than you. Your response usually isn't to start screaming, but is, at least for me, why do you believe that? Like, you're crazy, but why? I need to find out where your crazy comes from. So the first thing we want to do is actually try to understand what other people believe. Okay, so an example. Some of you were around last year, and I don't even remember the series we were doing, but we were talking about praying to saints. Do you remember this? And I was talking about in the Catholic Church, they pray to saints. And there was somebody in the front row that was like, whoa, that's not what we do. And I knew that's not what they do. And I was trying to explain to you all that in the Catholic Church, I was taught like, hey, they're praying to saints. And we don't pray to saints. We only pray to Jesus, God. Like, we do that. Like, we don't pray to saints. And as I got to know Catholics, I found out that that's not the intent. It's not that they think that the saint is going to heal them or give them safe travel or anything, but they actually want to pray with the saints is the right word. And that comes out of Hebrews chapter 12, where therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles. And this idea that comes from Hebrews, that the saints are watching in some way, that the author of Hebrews has this idea that we're in an arena with the saints all watching. And so the idea is that they ask the saints to pray on their behalf. And I still don't pray to saints to this day, but I understand why they do what they do. And it's not as crazy as it was taught to me when I was younger, when it was straw men that we set up and then torched. Does that make sense? So what we're going to try to do is we work through these things, and I'm going to try each week to help us get into the mind of the people that are on the other side of wherever you are, to try to understand, oh, well, there's a good reason why people believe what they believe about pacifism or just war theory or whatever. There's a good reason why they believe that thing, even if I don't agree. Okay? The second thing we're going to try to do as we work this series is we're going to then, this is the next step, if I understand, then to appreciate why this person believes what they do. So to say, I am not this, but I understand why this person believes, and furthermore, I even appreciate in them what's led them to this place in their life. We talked about respecting other people's ideas. This is what we're talking about, to get to that place of understanding first and then moving to a place of, I see how you get there. You're not crazy. You're not dumb for thinking differently than me. I see your journey, and I appreciate the journey God has brought you on in this regard. And then finally, what we're going to do is we're going to try to honor and serve the other. That I think our call to each other, our call, if you read through the scriptures, and we didn't have time again, but talk through all the one another's in the New Testament pages, we're supposed to serve and honor and respect one another. And there's even some of those kinds of words here in 1 Corinthians 13. And so we're going to work our best to, when it comes to these kinds of things, when we're talking about, and somebody comes to you and says, you know what somebody in your church believes? They believe this. Even if I disagree, I'm going to try to disagree in a way that shows honor to that person who thinks differently than I. Okay, am I totally crazy, or is this like completely impossible to do, right? It feels to me like as I was working on this on Tuesday, I'm like, yeah, this is impossible. I don't know how we're going to do this because I think our culture tells us that we can't do those things. There's this pastor, and I like his blog, and he says that it's impossible for a church not to be on one side or another of the gay issue. You have to pick a side. Because he would say, we can't do this. This is not possible in church. You have to pick one or the other. And so we're going to try, because we believe in generous orthodoxy, we're going to try to do what we're going to boldly go where no church has gone before. So. And so, what we're going to do every single week, somebody came up to me, I didn't even have this idea, somebody came up to me after church last week and said, if you're going to do this series and you're going to talk about these things, then my suggestion is this, that after every service, after we talk about contentious things and after I make people feel uncomfortable, we're going to end every service for the next several weeks, whenever we do this topic, we're going to end this service by coming to the table together. And I want you to think about just the nitty-gritty of coming to the table together. That when we come to the table, we all come to the same level and we're all served in the same way, regardless of what we think about the issues. And as we come up here, we kind of bump into each other and we kind of jostle each other and we catch somebody's eye and we smile at somebody, and maybe there's somebody that we haven't seen in a while and we hug them, and there's somebody in front of us that we really care about. We put our hand on their shoulder and scratch their back, pat their head, whatever, pat their head if they're down here. But that we act as a body. That what we're going to do in the service at the end is we're going to talk about this, but then we are going to every week act out our unity together. And I thought when somebody gave me that suggestion last week, I thought that was brilliant. And so that's what we're going to do at the end of this service. That's what we're going to do at the end of every service in this series. Because if we're going to talk about things that could get some of us kind of riled up about issues, it's important that we end our time together by coming back and affirming what we all hold in common. Okay? Let's pray together. God, as we journey into this, there's a lot of minefields and a lot of people around us. And I know that in probably every one of those issues, people in this church, we've been in those kinds of conversations. And some of us have been shunned from communities. We've left communities. We've had relationships damaged by conversations about those things. And so we ask, Father, as we move through this, give us wisdom, help us to know the right words to say, help us know how to do that impossible list in 1 Corinthians 13, help us to know how to blanket all of this in love, and help us, even when we disagree with each other, to understand and to appreciate and to honor and serve each other. In your name, amen. All right, here we go. In the context I grew up in, I think the reason I did this one today is because I've only given myself about 10 minutes to get through this one, all right? 15, all right? And here's why I chose to do this one today, is my guess is I've been a pastor here at this church since it started, but I can't remember the dates, whatever, 7 years. I don't know that I've had more than one or two conversations in 7 years about this topic. Unlike the other ones on the list, where I've had many, 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 many conversations about this one, my suspicion is that in this context, I don't think this is a hot button issue for most of us. I don't think most of you are sitting in your small groups and having coffee with friends and arguing about this very often. And if I'm wrong, I'm sorry. It's just my read on the church, so I'm going to move very, very quickly through this this morning. But in my upbringing, this was the issue. In fact, at an early age, I knew what the Scopes Monkey Trial was. And I'm guessing, how many of you know what the Scopes Monkey Trial is? About half, all right? How many of you, let's do it with Bruce did. Bruce was honest. How many of you know the name, but really not much else about it, all right? Yeah, okay, so in 1925, in Dayton, Tennessee, there was a law in Tennessee that said you could not teach evolution in public schools, okay? The ACLU didn't really like that law so much for obvious reasons, and so the ACLU set out in 1925 to find a test case that they could bring to try to get that law repealed, to basically work that law up through to the Supreme Court and get it repealed. And so eventually they found, I think there's some background story about Dayton, Tennessee decided a good PR campaign. Nobody knows Dayton, Tennessee, so we're going to get people excited about our town. And so they actually like tried to get it there. And so there's a teacher, and his name was John Scopes. And he taught evolution in public schools. Now, later on, interesting side note, historically, he says later on, I don't ever recall a single instance of actually teaching evolution in public schools, but I was willing to say I did. So, anyway, so this case should have been, you know, like, it's a misdemeanor, right? In the end, he was fined $100, which today's money is like $1,300 and $1,345. I tend to remember weird things. But it was, and then it was hyped for the defense. Representing John Scopes came in Clarence Darrow. Clarence Darrow was a famous defense attorney at the time. Towards the end of his career, I don't even know how to describe how famous he was. He was a big deal. And so he came in town to defend John Scopes on a misdemeanor charge. And then the prosecution needed somebody. So they brought William Jennings Bryan. If you know U.S. history, he ran for president 3 times, orator, statesman. They brought him to speak on their behalf. And so for a misdemeanor. And so then they argued back and forth, and it was so huge. It was like front page of the New York Times in 1925. That's how big the media circus was around the Scopes Monkey trial. And the reason it got so big is because, and this is why I heard about this when I was a kid, is because this trial went beyond a very simple case. Did you teach evolution in public schools? Yes, I did. Here's your $100 fine. It should have been a very, very simple case, but this thing turned into an argument about, is the Bible really true? Is the Bible a source of knowledge? Can we trust the Bible when it comes to education? And it got really, really big about all the big things about this topic. And so, as I was growing up, I don't remember this so much in my home, but I remember this more in the public, or in, not public schools, no, in the Christian schools I grew up in. The Scopes Monkey trial was a really big deal because it pitted fundamentalists, which we were, against modernism, against science, and it was a really big deal. It was seen as a watershed moment in American history. And so I remember when I was in high school at Peoria Christian, and I don't know what they teach about creation evolution these days. I'm not up on it. But I know that when I was in high school there, we brought in a speaker named Ken Ham. It was before he was as famous as he is now. He was here in Peoria. And I remember him putting this slide up on the screen, and he was talking about how important this issue is. Anybody ever seen this graphic before? Billy. All right, Billy, you and I have seen this graphic. And Jennifer. Jennifer has seen this graphic as well. This was a huge deal. And I didn't see it all. It's all fancy now. When I saw it, I think it was a stick drawing that he did. But the idea was is that he said, you know, there's two worldviews, there's two kingdoms here, and the Christians are shooting at all the issues up here. Meanwhile, they're shooting at the foundation because they're saying that we cannot trust the Bible. And the Scopes Monkey trial and creation evolution, the reason it's a big deal in many places, and you may be puzzled. I talked to some of you I know, and you're like, this is not a big deal to me. I don't understand why it's a big deal. The reason why this is a big deal to a lot of people is because they feel like when you say, if you say, I believe in evolution, that you're shooting away the foundation of God's word. If we don't know, if we can't trust the Bible here, then how do we know anything at all? And so this issue, I say that I go past it quickly, but it's really, I just want you to, this is part of the understanding that maybe for your parents or your grandparents or your friend who's more conservative than you, and they get really worked up about creation and evolution, this is why they're getting so worked up. It's a big deal to them because it's about everything. Is that clear? Okay. So I want to give you kind of the landscape and help you understand where we're at. I'll go through this quickly because I think you all know most of this. So on the far right, let's put them, is the young earth creationists. These folks believe that when we read Genesis, it happened exactly like that. God spoke, probably not in English, but maybe, and then there was atmosphere. So we're not even sure that when he spoke, how it happened because there was no air. But he spoke and it happened in 6 days. They believe in a young earth. They believe that the earth has only been here for about 5,500, 6,000 years, depending on who you're talking to and their theories. But they believe in a very, very young earth, okay? The next level over is I put a group that I call creationists. People who believe the Bible, that God actually spoke and things came into existence. They don't necessarily believe that it had to have happened 6,000 years ago. They don't even, maybe some of them, as you start moving this way, don't even believe that maybe even God did it in literal days, that they might believe that God did it in each day that we see in Genesis is really more like 1,000 years, so that God is the one actually creating the animals, but maybe the time frames are a little bit different, and so they go a little bit that way. I'm going to jump to the far side then, and the far side I'll call atheistic evolutionists. These are people who don't believe in God, and they don't believe the Bible at all, right? So that's just not even part, to have a conversation with them about, but Genesis says it's not even worth even starting because, yeah, and so does Dr. Seuss. That's what it sounds like to them. Well, Dr. Seuss said the earth was created in three, like that's what they hear when you say the Bible says. On that side. And then maybe the next group in is just your garden variety evolutionists who are, you know, they believe in evolution. They're not ready to close the door on God yet. And then in the middle is all kinds of hybrid theories. It could be fun and a little crazy if I just set up a mic and said, all right, everybody, let's have hybrid theory time, because everybody's got one. That's the thing about opinions, right? Everybody's got one. And so you may be in that space where you say, well, I pull some of this over here, but this over here, and I put it together, and here's what, this is the kind of thing that after you've been in a bar with some friends and they've had a drink or two, they say, you want to know how the world really came into being? Let me tell you. I've got it all worked out, right? So that's the hybrid. I'm not trying to mock the people there in the middle there at all. I'm just saying that there's all kinds. You can go online and just find all kinds of different options then for how people think through this and put it together. Because here's the thing. When we start talking about creation and evolution, you know what? None of us were there. None of us actually saw it. And so everybody has a theory. And so we're working through it. So a couple things I want to give you to help understand then to frame this debate. One is that this is the graph of belief in God. I mentioned that already, right? So let's just, for simplicity's sake, I know we could argue about this and make it, so theoretically, maybe there's a young earth creationist who doesn't believe in God. I would think that would be a really strange person. But in the course of research this week, I found a guy who taught that the earth is a bowl, not a globe. So people believe lots of things, all right? And he was serious. He was an hour and 20 minutes of YouTube serious. I did not watch the whole thing, just to be clear about how I spend my week, all right? So, belief in God, maybe going the other way, is confidence in observable science. So, if you watch the Ken Ham, Bill Nye debate, by the way, those two men are really the extremes on this chart, right? Ken Ham is the young earth creationist. Bill Nye is the atheistic. I'm pretty sure Bill Nye is an atheist. I mean, is that right? I believe he is. That part of their debate was Bill Nye saying, well, here's the observable science. Here's how the stars are moving, and here's blue shift, red shift, something or another about stars shifting colors. And he was saying all that, and then Bill Nye kept on saying, but there's an answer to that, and it's found in the pages of the Bible. And so it really, that debate, if you want to get a taste for the extremes here, beautiful, because they both played like perfect parts. Bill Nye saying, here's all the observable science, and Ken Ham saying, but the Bible says this, and the Bible says this, and the Bible says this. And then maybe here, let's put one more in, biblical literalism. So I need to spend a little bit of time here. So I don't want to walk away from this and you say, well, all Christians are over here and all non-Christians are over there, because that's hurt a lot of people. And I know people in our church who have grown up in context where they felt like, I'm either a young earth creationist or I'm not a Christian, because there's no place for me. And so what we're talking about here is the degree to which we take the Bible literally, all right? So that when it says It was created in a day. We mean that to be a 24-hour period. When it says on the far right, when God spoke the creation into existence, a biblical literalist says, well, it said he spoke, therefore words came out of God's mouth, and that's how the creation came into being. The more you go to the left, the more people say, well, that might just be an image of something or a picture of something or a metaphor for something. So for example, let me put this even more clearly. Let's jump out of creation evolution. Let's talk about the resurrection of Jesus. I believe in a literal bodily resurrection of Jesus, okay? But there are scholars out there who I understand and I appreciate and I honor who don't believe that the resurrection of Jesus is a literal event. They believe it was a metaphor for a spiritual awakening that happened in the disciples in the first century. They're not literalists. They're over there. Does that make sense? All right? So that's what we're talking about here, is the degree to which, the difference between creationists and young earth creationists is the degree to which they take the passage literally. So they make choices about which parts to take literally and which parts we don't. The thing is, I want to say very clearly, is we all make those choices all the time when we read our Bibles, right? Every single one of us, even if you're way over on the far scale, because to be a biblical literalist, to go to the far scale is you have to believe the world looks like this. Because when you read Genesis 1, I got this off of a blog post that said the problem with biblical literalists is they don't go far enough. Because the Bible talks about there's a dome over the earth. And in that dome, God put the stars and the moon and the sun. So there's a dome with the sun and moon and stars on it. And I don't think even biblical young earth creationists believe that. They understand that to be, you know, metaphorical or trying to explain something that they can't really get today. So that's the deal. That's literalism. And then this is my favorite slide. They both say, young earth creationists are blinded by belief. Evolutionists are blinded by disbelief. They both believe the others are blind because they have blind beliefs before they even walk into this whole debate, which is true of all of us. See, before you even start to have a conversation about creation and evolution, you've already made up your mind mostly about where you're going to land on this topic based on what you think about the Bible and the nature of God and the nature of how you know what you know. And what we're going to find is when we get really generous about our orthodoxy, we're going to find that's true, I think, most of the time. Well, we all like to think that we're rational creatures and that we come to our opinions because we've reasoned it out and it's a superior reasoning. But often we find, most often we find, if we really dig and if we're willing to let ourselves dig and we're willing to open ourselves up to these possibilities, that we believe what we believe because we decided we understand what the Bible, we've decided where we land on the biblical literalism scale before we've actually even opened the book. We've decided how we know what we know. And so, you know, Bill Nye has decided he knows what he knows because of biblical science. Ken Ham knows what he knows because he reads it in Genesis 1. They decided that before they actually read the accounts. They've already made up their mind about that point. And so that's part of the struggle for all of us, is our experiences and all of those things shape the way we come to these questions. Well, I'm running really low on time, so let me say three quick things about creation evolution and try to get us to a place where we can take communion together. You may have heard people say that there are other accounts of the creation in the culture, and your friends are absolutely right. The Enuma Elish is an Akkadian piece of literature that talks about how Marduk created the world, yada, yada. And if you read the Enuma Elish and hold it up against Genesis, man, there's a lot of copying. Somebody's copying somebody a lot there because they have kind of the same things going on, the same characters. I had a summary written up. The Enuma Elish argues for the supremacy of Marduk and the creation of human beings to serve the gods. The Genesis 1 account argues for the supremacy of Yahweh, just like Marduk, but it talks about the creation of human beings as his image bearers in the world. And so part of what is happening, and one of the questions we need to ask when we come to these stories, and we did this all summer with the Sunday school stories, is why do these stories even exist? What questions were ancient peoples asking that led them to say, what question did the kid ask that the dad felt like, this is the time where I start, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, right? So you're a parent, and you know that there's certain things that when your kids ask, you're, okay, my kid's talking about this. It's time for the drug talk. It's time for, like, you just know as a parent, like, there's different moments that this is the time where I have to step up and tell this story. I have to tell this thing. I have to teach my kids this. And I believe a lot of these stories happened, I know they all happened in an oral tradition first, likely in a setting where somebody in the community, maybe a child, asked, what's our place in the world? Where do we come from? And one of our ancestors says, well, in the beginning, God created, and that got passed down, and that kid learned it. And so when that kid grew up, and somebody asked, and their kid asked, and their kid, and their kid, and their kid, and their kid, they kept repeating these stories. And so it's important for us to answer this question, why do these stories then exist? What was the question that triggered the telling of these kinds of stories? Now, I think when it comes to the creation narrative, it was probably assembled. I don't know when the oral tradition started. That's impossible to know. But it's at least the written form, it appears that it looks like they actually wrote it down in Babylonian captivity when Israel was asking questions about who are we? Are we still God's people? What's our place in the world? And I'm just going to give you a little hint, a little tease, all right? That one of the things that struck me just a couple weeks ago, I was thinking about this, is that I've always come to the Genesis 1 story and heard it as a story about God. And it is a story about God. God speaks and this happens and this happens and this happens. But one of the things that struck me is at the end of that passage is when he creates male and female and puts them in the garden and says, these are my image bearers. And I've referred to this a couple times this summer in offhanded ways because I read it in a book, and it's just brilliant to me that maybe the writers of Genesis chapter 1, some people believe that it was written, it was assembled by priests. And so what they were doing is some of what's happening in that story is it looks like a temple inauguration story that it's a comparable piece of literature to if you were going to build a temple, you describe the temple, describe the temple, describe the temple. And then at the very end of the describing of the temple, the last thing you do when you build a temple is do what? You put the God in the center of the temple to be worshipped. And that maybe what's happening in the Genesis 1, the reason why they put the story in there is it was a description of the temple being built all around us so that at the end of the story, he could put the image bearers in the center of the temple. And I think that idea, and that's got me turning on this now. It's got me thinking again about why the creation story. Well, maybe the creation story that we have in the Bible is to answer the question, is our place in the world? What is our place? What's my place? What's your place? And the answer in Genesis is that we are to be the image bearers of the God who is supreme to Marduk and all the other Babylonian gods. And so, I think what we're going to do this morning to finish this is I'm going to read Genesis chapter 1. And I hope that sitting where you sit, maybe as I read, you're thinking through how you think that the world was created, that literally. And maybe some of you think the other way, and you're going to listen, and you're just going to worship God as beautiful and as the author of life, and however you understand that. And that we're all going to come to this place where we agree that in this passage, it moves to this expression of human beings as his image bearers. And then we're going to move to communion together. So let's read Genesis chapter 1 to finish our time together. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty, and darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, let there be light, and there was light, and God saw the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness, and God called the light day, and the darkness he called night, and there was evening, and there was morning the first day. And God said, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. And God called the vault sky. And there was evening and there was morning the second day. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered into one place and let dry ground appear. And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land, and bear fruit with seed in it according to the various kinds. And it was so. And the land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the third day. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark the sacred times and days and years, and let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. And God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. And God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from the darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning the fourth day. And God said, let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky. So God created the great creatures of the sea and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. And God blessed them and said, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let their birds increase on the earth. And there was evening and there was morning the fifth day. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. And God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground and according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food, and to all the beasts of the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so. And God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening and there was morning the sixth day, and thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing, so on the seventh day he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. God, we worship you this morning as the creator, as the one who is beautiful and is the source of life. And we understand that in our church probably in wildly different ways. And some of us take this a lot more literally and some a lot less. But we don't negate who you are behind it all. And so we worship together, God, as we move through our pews and as we jostle the people as we come together. God, help us to be one church. Help our unity be a mark of our maturity. In your name I pray. Amen.